Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Multi-Jurisdictional CAS meeting. For the duration of today's conference, all participant lines are on a listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. It is my pleasure to turn the call over to your host for today, Dr. Ola Awodelli.
Thank you very much, Holly. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Multi-Jurisdictional Contractor Advisory Committee, or also known as a CAC meeting, on botulinum toxins injections. My name is Ola Awodelli, as she said, and I'm a contractor medical director with NGS. This is a multi-jurisdictional CAC, as it says on the title, and that means that it's all of the MACs, Medicare MACs that have parts A and B that have come together to have this CAC meeting, and everyone will be participating today. And that includes National Government Services, as I said. We're acting as the host, Noridian, Novitas Solutions, First Coast, Wisconsin Physician Services, Palmetto GBA, and CGS. The purpose of today's session is outlined in CMS IOM Publications 100-8, Chapter 13, Sections 13.2.4.3, which basically says the purpose of today's meeting is to listen to our distinguished subject matter experts who have volunteered to evaluate the medical evidence regarding botulinum toxins for various disease conditions. Please understand that this meeting is open to the public. However, only the contractor medical directors and the subject matter experts will be speaking during this call. Each of the seven contractor medical directors, if you could please introduce yourself, and by that I mean the people who will be asking the questions by disease category. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here, and thanks for the introduction. My name is Dr. Claudia Campos, and I'm with First Coast and Novitas. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dr. Bob Kettler with WPS.
Hello, this is Dr. Meredith Loveless with CGS.
Hi, Eileen Moynihan with Noridian.
Hi, Scott Tramus with Palmetto.
Thank you very much. Before we go any further, I will also ask our panel of experts who are located across the various jurisdictions to please introduce themselves. When you're doing so, please state your name, your affiliation, and acknowledge any possible conflicts of interest. So if we can begin with Dr. Prakash Gwali, please. Dr. Gwali?
Yes.
If you could please introduce yourself and state by stating your name, affiliation, and any possible conflicts of interest. Thank you.
This is Prakash Gwali at Washington University in St. Louis. I'm an esophagologist, and I have no conflicts of interest.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Kelly Andrzejewski?
Hi, I'm Dr. Kelly Andrzejewski from the University of Buffalo in Buffalo, New York. I'm a movement disorder neurologist in Buffalo, and my only conflict is I'm a speaker for TAVA.
Thank you. Dr. Subramanian?
Hi, this is Prem Subramanian. I am at the University of Colorado St. Anschutz Rogers Eye Center in Aurora, Colorado. And I am a neuro-ophthalmologist and orbital surgeon. I have no relevant conflicts of interest.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Xian Yang? Xian Yang?
Hi, this is Linda. She will be joining later.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Dr. Pham Chow?
Hi, my name is Chow Pham. I'm an oculofacial plastic surgeon here at the University of Iowa. I have no relevant conflicts of interest.
Thank you. Dr. Tisha Monte.
Since my conflicts of interest include its advisory board for AbbVie, also educational grants for Mertz advisory work or consultation work, and not quite yet, but soon to be clinical trial for Ipsen, and also ongoing clinical trial for AbbVie. I have other conflicts of interest as it relates to other therapeutic products, but not specifically neurotoxins.
Thank you. Could you state your affiliation? I think we only kind of heard half. We only heard the conflicts of interest. We didn't hear you introduce yourself nor your affiliation.
Yes. My name was already mentioned. I'm Dr. Tisha May Monteith at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. I'm Associate Professor of Clinical Neurology.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Sonia Knight.
Yes, hi. I'm Dr. Sonia Knight. I'm a private practice neurologist and psychiatrist with a practice in outskirts of Philadelphia called Neurology, Psychiatry, and Balance Therapy Center, and I have no relevant conflict of interest.
Thank you very much. Dr. Park?
Hi, my name is Dr. Amy Park. I'm a urogynecologist at the Cleveland Clinic. I also am here on behalf of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology.
Thank you. Dr. Ferzandi? Dr. Ferzandi? Okay. Dr. Garrett?
Hi, I'm Galen Garrett. I'm an otolaryngologist at Vanderbilt University, and I specifically specialize in voice disorders. I have no conflicts of interest.
Thanks. Dr. Barada?
Hi, my name is John Barada. I'm an assistant professor in physical medicine and rehabilitation at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I have no relevant conflicts of interest.
Thank you. And Dr. Kwasnica?
Hi, this is Dr. Tina Kwasnica. I am the chair of physical medicine and neurorehabilitation at Barrow Neurological Institute, and my conflict of interest is Speakers Bureau for AbbVie.
Thank you very much. So next on the agenda are key questions and discussions. So prior to this meeting, our CNDs from all the MACs completed a review of the literature and prepared a list of articles for review by our subject matter experts. Our panel of experts will comment on these articles and any additional evidence of which they may be aware. We have prepared a series of questions by disease category and will ask our subject matter expert for his or her response and then ask the other subject matter experts if they have anything to add or discuss. If any of the general questions apply to your topic, please do not hesitate to address this question. This would also be asked by your CND. Due to time constraints, please remember we want to limit it to about 5 minutes per answer. We do understand that there might be more time needed if necessary. The answers to these questions should be based on the literature and be in alignment with good clinical practice and guidelines. Also, if the literature is silent or inconclusive on a particular issue, we would appreciate if our subject matter experts note that. So we will now begin with the questions. And like I said, we're going to go questions by disease category. And the first one is achalasia, and it would be moderated by Dr. Campbell. Dr. Campbell? Dr. Campbell and Dr. Gwali.
Could you hear me? Can you hear me?
No, we can hear you now. Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, sorry. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is there evidence to support the use of botulinum toxin injections as a treatment for achalasia?
The answer is yes. There is evidence, but one has to understand the scenarios
in which achalasia can be treated with botulinum toxin, because achalasia is a lifelong disease and botulinum toxin effects are not permanent. They generally last a median of 6 to 9 months, sometimes a little longer. And for that reason, patients who have achalasia who can tolerate invasive managements, more permanent managements, tend to be treated better with more durable symptom response with these permanent treatments like myotomy or cutting of the muscle or pneumatic dilation, which is tearing of the muscle of the lower esophageal sphincter. So what the literature supports is using botulinum toxin in a few clinical scenarios. One is in patients who cannot tolerate these invasive treatments because of comorbid conditions. They cannot tolerate surgery, for instance, for myotomy, or they cannot tolerate an invasive dilation that may have a complication of a perforation that may require surgery. Then it is reasonable to use recurrent injections of botulinum toxin. The second scenario is when a patient has to wait for their definitive treatment for whatever reason. If there is a waiting period involved, then botulinum toxin injection can temporize their treatment. The third scenario is if the diagnosis of an achalasia-like disorder, and this includes other spastic disorders within the broad achalasia spectrum, if the diagnosis is unclear before somebody goes and does something permanent that is irreversible, it is reasonable to do a botulinum toxin trial so that if symptoms improve with botulinum toxin in patients where the diagnosis is not completely certain, that will add confidence to doing something irreversible to the patient's esophagus. And a sub-indication under that category is an achalasia-like pattern that is induced by the use of opioid medication. We have learned about this disorder in recent years, and opioids can create an esophageal movement pattern that can be similar to some forms of achalasia. And so sometimes there is a philosophical issue about doing something permanent to the esophagus when it is caused by a medication that could be potentially changed to something else. In those settings, again, botulinum toxin may be a means of temporizing symptoms.
We can't hear you, Dr. Campos.
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
Okay. Yes, we can.
Thank you. Can I follow up with another question regarding using botulinum toxin to see whether more permanent treatments would be beneficial? Is there is that still the case with advances in diagnosis of achalasia? Like syndromes using functional lumen imaging and complementary physiological testing in addition to high-resolution manometry?
Yes, actually that has created a bigger need for using botulinum toxin as a diagnostic method because of the higher sensitivity of some of these newer tests in finding obstructive esophageal syndromes. So the old manometry tests and the liquid barium studies that we were using do not have the same sensitivity and specificity as some of these newer tests. And the other issue is sometimes one test shows an achalasia-like syndrome and the next test may not. The more tests that show the similar pattern increases confidence in how we manage these disorders. So if there is discrepancy between these tests, or if the newer tests show an obstructive pattern that the older tests that we relied on didn't, then that there arises a situation where you'd want to do something temporary to the esophagus rather than something permanent until you're sure that something permanent and irreversible is warranted.
Thank you. And what treatments, if any, should be tried prior to using botulinum toxin injections for achalasia?
There are really no other simpler treatments that have a reliable benefit as botulinum toxin does. It is the least invasive of the treatments that provide good relief. For instance, smooth muscle relaxants, medicines like nitrates and calcium channel blockers have only a 30 to 50% efficacy with a very high rate of symptoms, side effects. On the other hand, early response to botulinum toxin is in the 60 to 70, sometimes even higher, percent range, even though benefits decay in 6 to 9 months. So among the simpler treatments, the non-invasive, even though botulinum toxin is invasive, and so treatments that are not surgery or myotomy of the muscle, botulinum toxin is probably the easiest and the safest.
Great, thank you. And moving on to some general questions, is there a dose response relationship with botulinum toxins in achalasia?
So the vast majority of studies have used 20 to 25 units injected in 4 to 5 sites in the LES area, so a total of 100 units of botulinum toxin, which is considered the standard dose. When people have tried injecting 200 units, so double the dose, in patients with esophageal spasm, diffuse esophageal spasm, which affects not just the lower esophageal sphincter, but also the esophageal body muscle, results have not been consistent. So the standard dose for achalasia and achalasia spectrum disorders is believed to be 100 units in 4 to 5 divided doses injected into the region of the lower esophageal sphincter.
Thank you. And is there evidence to support any frequency intervals and total treatment duration?
So again, this goes back to my answer to the first question. It really depends on the individual patient's duration of response and the indication for the injection in the first place. So if the indication for botulinum toxin is the patient just cannot tolerate anything more invasive, then we keep doing it when the symptoms recur for life. On the other hand, if it is being done as a therapeutic trial and the patient responds, when the symptoms come back, you would go ahead and do something more invasive. The duration is not a fixed, or the intervals is not a fixed interval for any given patient, so you wouldn't just schedule a repeat botulinum toxin. You'd tell the patient to report back when their symptoms recurred, and then plan the next injection if the plan was for recurring injections.
Excellent, thank you. And is there evidence to support using botulinum toxin B?
There isn't literature to support for or against any other serotypes or any other formulations of botulinum toxin. Now, just based on how botulinum toxin works, if that was what was available, I don't think there would be an issue with response, but there are no specific data that support or refute the use of the B serotype.
Okay, and just our last question, what contraindications exist for the use of botulinum toxin and what are the long-term effects when you use it?
So there are really no specific contraindications for botulinum toxin other than hypersensitivity or allergy. And in my almost 30 years of doing this, I have not encountered a single patient that was allergic or developed an anaphylactic reaction to this. Is it possible? Yes. Does it happen frequently? Not really. So most of the contraindications and the cautions for using botulinum toxin really are the contraindications and cautions for endoscopy in general, because this is done during sedated endoscopy. And all the risks of endoscopy, including aspiration and the risk of bleeding if the person is on a blood thinner, are real and need to be considered, just as we do for any other endoscopy. Are there any long-term consequences? The biggest consequence of disrupting or making the lower esophageal sphincter relax is reflux. And indeed, if the patient has reflux, we decide that the botulinum toxin actually worked. If the patient who couldn't eat is now having reflux symptoms, it means that the original problem of the lower esophageal sphincter not relaxing has been resolved, and the reflux that occurs is easily treated with postural measures and with medications. Now, injection of botulinum toxin can create fibrosis in the submucosal areas, and if subsequent surgery or myotomy were to be planned, it might make the process of dissection a little bit more cumbersome, but there is no evidence to suggest that that risk of fibrosis alone should deter somebody from using botulinum toxin if it were indicated. There is just one death reported with the use of botulinum toxin that I know of, and that was when the injection technique was probably not followed, and some botulinum toxin got into the mediastinum, and the patient developed a mediastinal infection and died. But in general, the long-term consequences mostly relate to reflux, and there are really no serious long-term consequences.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Campos and Dr. Gowali. I just wanted to remind everybody we have
time
in terms of keeping to time, and I think what I'm going to do is when you have about five more minutes, Stephanie will interject and just call, 5 minutes more, that kind of a thing, in time, just so that we can, because we have a packed agenda. So, Dr. Campos, you're going to continue with Dr. Andrzejewski and focal hand dystonia.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Andrzejewski, are there diagnostic criteria for diagnosing focal hand dystonia?
I think it's mostly based on clinical exam patients' complaint of something like writer's cramp are some of the primary reasons.
Good. And what is the incidence and prevalence of the disorder which would need botulinum toxin treatment?
If the symptoms are obviously bothersome to the patient, they certainly would, it would be an improved indication to treat them with Botox.
And is there evidence to support the use of botulinum toxin injections as a first-line treatment for severe focal hand dystonia?
I would say yes, there is. It avoids use of oral medications that can have significant side effects, such as muscle relaxants. So I would say that should be a first-line treatment and is much less invasive.
Okay. And what treatments, if any, should be unsuccessful used prior to using botulinum toxin injection?
I don't think there is any. I think Botox should be first-line.
And what objective criteria or scale should be used to measure treatment benefits and outcomes for focal hand dystonia?
I think you can use probably the dystonia, unified dystonia rating scale and assist with that.
And is that used in clinical practice?
In some cases, yes.
Okay.
Probably very physician dependent.
Okay. So let's move on to our general questions about dosage. Is there a dosage range that you would recommend?
I think the one supported by the FDA is accurate. Correct.
Okay. And is there a dose-response relationship?
Certainly, higher doses can have more significant effects. So if a patient remains refractory to kind of a starting, initially recommended dose, using a higher dose is certainly warranted.
Okay. And is that a trade-off with weakness unwanted?
Say that again. Is that a...
Is that a trade-off by increasing your dose of botulinum toxin? Would that impair your functionality and causing more weakness?
Yes, it can cause excessive weakness, but without we have to explain to patients that it's a bit of trial and error. That's why we start low, and then if the patient does not have enough response to the first round of injections, the dosage would have to be increased at the next set of injections.
And is there evidence to support any frequency intervals and total treatment durations?
I think starting typically at every, roughly 12 weeks or 3 months or 90 days is appropriate, but the importance of having patients as well as physicians or providers monitor, because certain patients do find that botulinum toxin wears off maybe at 8 weeks or 10 weeks, and then if that is the case, if that is demonstrated that the patient has benefit but it wears off earlier, I think there should be indication that it should be able to be approved earlier depending on the patient outcome.
Okay. And is there evidence to support using botulinum toxin B?
I would say yes.
And are all of them interchangeably?
I think they're all interchangeable, but obviously dosing varies depending on the type of toxin, because in most cases the toxin is not like one equivalent unit of Botox is not equal necessarily an equivalent to a different brand, one unit of a different brand, with the exception of probably Xeomin and Botox.
Okay. And what is the tolerance development with botulinum toxin and the role of antibody testing?
I don't typically, in my experience, do routine antibody testing. If the toxin fails to work, then I would switch them to a different brand.
Great, thank you. And what contraindications exist for the use of botulinum toxin?
I think other than if the patient is on something like blood thinners, that may make, you'd have to advise them that obviously doing injections can put increased risk of compartment syndrome or bleeding within to the muscle compartment. If patients obviously have conditions like myasthenia gravis or other conditions that may already involve neuromuscular weakness, then that would probably be contraindicated.
Okay, thank you. And our last question is, what are the long-term effects of botulinum toxin in dystonia?
In this case, typically the effects last on average 12 weeks. Long-term benefit, I think, is improvement in quality of life.
Good. And any downsides?
I think other than risk of excessive weakness or compartment syndrome, especially in patients that are on anticoagulation.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campos. And Dr. Andrzejewski, you can stay on because we're going to
go by Dr. Kelly.
Dr. Kelly. Okay. I also have a name where I tell people, just call me Dr. Ola as well, so thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to have Dr. Subramanian join you and Dr. Yang. Dr. Trimas is going to be the moderator. So Dr. Trimas, take it away.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for joining us. I have a couple questions to start with on hemifacial spasm and facial dystonia. So the first question, is there any evidence support the use of botulinum toxin injections as first-line treatment for hemifacial spasm, whether it's idiopathic or secondary to compression?
Do I go first, or is
this? Sure, why don't you go first for this one?
Oh, okay. So, in my opinion, I think it is first-line treatment. Again, avoid use of muscle relaxants or other medications that can have significantly sedating effects, and it also allows focal treatment versus a treatment that could involve have side effects on muscle body regions if taken orally, such as baclofen.
And I would just add to that that there is probably 30 years of literature, at least, that through a variety of trials showing that 75 to 95% of individuals with hemifacial spasm, whether it's primary or secondary, will have a clinically relevant response to botulinum toxin injection, and that it is very well tolerated in those patients.
Anybody else for that first question?
Dr. Trima, sorry, I just wanted to interject. We're hearing a lot of typing going on online. Could that person please mute themselves, please? Thank you very much, because it's being recorded just so that it can be clear on the recording. Appreciate it. Sorry, Scott, you can continue.
That's okay. Is there any other, I have a third person. Is there any other comments on that first question? No. Okay, so the second question is, what treatments, if any, would be considered failures prior to using botulinum toxins for hemifacial spasm?
I could start on this one. I would say that the literature would show that failure of other treatments is not a requirement for treating patients with botulinum toxin. In fact, the literature is quite robust in supporting trying botulinum toxin first. As Dr. Kelly said, that the use of alternative medications is associated with a much lower efficacy and with an increased side effect profile, and so no other treatment would be considered failure. I would say the one thing is that there are some individuals who have primary hemifacial spasm from neurovascular compression at the root exit zone of the facial nerve, and they may undergo a microvascular decompression, and they may fail that. They may still have some degree of hemifacial spasm even afterward, and so those individuals may still be good candidates for botulinum toxin treatment postoperatively.
All right. I have a question along those lines, though, and I hate to deviate from the normal questions, but my question is, if a patient had, for example, an acoustic neuroma surgery or something else in the cerebellopontine angle, and because you briefly kind of mentioned or alluded to this when you talked about microvascular decompression, if someone had that, is there a time period you should wait after surgery before, let's say they develop hemifacial spasms within X amount of time after the procedure, you know, several weeks, several months, should you wait any period of time before instituting botulinum toxin therapy?
Well, I can respond to that again. I would say that the development of the heavy facial spasm usually takes some time after. So these are two separate things, right? The injury to the facial nerve that may occur leading to hemifacial spasm as opposed to the pathophysiology of most so-called primary hemifacial spasm, which is also the vascular compression. So talking about these secondary cases where there is a development after a procedure, I'm not aware of strong evidence that would set a specific time point after which recovery would not be expected or spontaneous regression would not be expected. And there are no clinical guidelines I'm aware of, but I would say that standard clinical practice would be that if the hemifacial spasm is present for more than 4 to 6 months and has not remitted, then that is certainly at a reasonable time point to try a single injection of botulinum toxin. And there may be a benefit to the patient to giving that single injection and then waiting longer than the typical retreatment period to see if that single injection was sufficient to get them through an acute or subacute phase, and that there might be some spontaneous regression of the symptomatology.
Thank you. So question number three, what objective criteria scale should be measure treatment benefits and outcomes of hemifacial spasm with botulinum toxin.
I'll let someone else start if they'd like.
So, I mean, there is, it looks like, an actual approved, like, validated hemifacial spasm grading scale, but this isn't something that I'll be honest, I typically use in clinical practice. I think it's a clinical diagnosis that it's observed and it's bothersome to the patient, deserves treatment.
Yeah, I think the way the question is phrased does not really match what is done in clinical practice, and it may be more relevant to any sort of clinical trial or clinical research that's being done to evaluate the efficacy. So these hemifacial spasm scales, I also don't use them and have not seen them presented at neuro-ophthalmology meetings in terms of measurement of outcomes of treatment more broadly of patients with hemifacial spasms. So one of the drawbacks, I think, of these hemifacial spasm scales is that they center very much upon objectively observed spasm of the upper and lower face and the frequency and duration of those spasms, but those may not correlate with actual quality of life effects of the hemifacial spasm and the improvement or lack of improvement with treatment or no treatment that the patient may experience.
Okay. Thank you. All right. For any question one, these are just general questions regarding the botulinum toxin for use in facial hemispasm. So for any condition, is there literature to support using a different dose other than the one approved by the FDA?
I think, again, in this case, it's really, it's a bit of an art. You have to look at the patient clinically, determine what components of the hemifacial spasm are bothersome. Is it more forehead? Is it more the lower half of their face? And from there, decide on dosing. Again, I would start within recommended FDA dosing, if not lower, depending on the patient. And then from there, you know, escalate the doses needed depending on the patient's response to treatment.
What about off-label uses of different, off-label uses for the different botulinum toxins? Is there any variation between effects?
There are some, there's some head-to-head studies suggesting that there's not a difference in effect other than, as was alluded to before, that you have to adjust the dosing for certain botulinum toxins that are not equivalent to onabotulinum toxin in terms of units, but I'm not aware of literature. There's some literature that suggests that onabotulinum toxin or incobotulinum toxin may be superior to the others, but it doesn't mean the others don't work. There's evidence for each of those to show that they work.
So there's obviously a dose-response relationship between different botulinum toxin injections and the doses that's used, so I don't want to repeat that question per se. So how about frequency intervals? Is there evidence to support limitations on frequency intervals and total treatment durations?
Go
ahead, Kelly.
I think, again, in this case, it would be depending on the patient's response. You know, I would typically see them back at 6 to 8 weeks to determine if they had a response, if they're still getting benefits, and plan for the normal 90-day interval. And if they come back and see me at 90 days and say, hey, my Botox wore off at 10 weeks, then you would request prior authorization to try to get approval for more frequent dosing, unless you thought that you should escalate the dose. But it's really following patients over time, and every patient can have a different response. Some people have a response for 8 weeks. Some people might have a response for 12 weeks. It just depends on the patient and their body.
And then I'll just add for total treatment duration, again, in terms of evidence, there are retrospective studies for 10, 15 years showing that there's continued efficacy. There's not necessarily, you may need to escalate dose a little bit over time, but that the treatment total duration between dosing probably stays about the same, as Kelly just said, for a given patient. And that I would say that limitations for treatment would be that if it's becoming less efficacious and either the dose is increased significantly or the duration between injections is shortening, that may be a time to consider a surgical alternative rather than continuing with the botulinum toxin injections.
We're at 5 minutes.
All right. Would that also justify changing serotypes? In other words, if you had a limited duration of effect with one botulinum toxin serotype, would that justify changing to a different serotype?
I'd say there's limited evidence on that, but it is a reason to consider switching based on some evidence that certain of the formulations are more or less immunogenic than others or may have a slightly different mechanism of inactivation.
All right. Okay. I don't think there's any necessity of body testing since it's already been questioned with that one. As far as are there any contraindications for that, and along that same line, are there any long-term lingering effects that need to be taken into consideration for continued treatment with the botulinum toxin injections for facial dystonia?
So you want to start?
Yeah, I think just, you know, knowing that people can have facial droop from obviously the Botox, but that would typically wear off with the as the effects of the medication or the Botox wore off botulinum toxin.
And I think I mentioned already that these studies of patients 10, 15 years and beyond have shown good long-term efficacy with repeated dosing, of course, but continued efficacy in most patients without significant adverse events. And in fact, the typical adverse events of using botulinum toxin like ptosis or dry eye actually go down over time when you look at these studies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Trimas and Dr. Kelly, Dr. Yang, Dr. Subramanian. So Dr. Kelly, you stay on, and Dr. Kettler will join you for the discussion of cervical dystonia.
Okay.
Dr. Kettler?
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Alladelli. Good afternoon, Dr. Kelly.
You too.
I'm going to ask this first question a little differently than it's printed here, but I think it gets to really the same information. And, you know, what I'd like to hear you discuss is what type of documentation should our reviewers look for to determine that is actually the appropriate diagnosis for that patient?
I mean, I think kind of the classic cervical dystonia rating scale, or the TWSTRS scale, is really kind of the gold standard for the grading and diagnosis of cervical dystonia. I mean, it's very easy, though. I mean, in my clinical practice, to describe, you know, the components of retrocollis, anterocollis, tilt, turn, rotation, things like that, and I think an accurate description of that within the physician's note that is used to request prior auscent should be sufficient. But in the same respect, if you're looking for a clinical grading scale, I would probably go with the TWSTRS scale, which is the Toronto Western Spasmodic Torticollis scale, if I have the abbreviations correct.
Okay. You know, are there other scales that people use to document the severity of the cervical dystonia?
I mean, you could use the Unified Dystonia Rating Scale, but I think for the use of, you know, for grading specifically cervical dystonia, that's probably the best one.
Okay. All right. Would you use that then for measuring the treatment effect, I guess, jumping ahead to question four?
I would say yes. In addition, so part of the TWSTRS scale, there's also kind of patient-reported outcomes, but it's not something I think in clinical practice we have time to necessarily have every patient fill out surveys rating the severity of their cervical dystonia. I think asking the patient's input on what they thought, if it was beneficial or not, is generally sufficient.
Okay. Is there a degree of regression in that Twister scale that you think would support doing an early Botox injection or re-injection?
Meaning like at 8 weeks instead of 12 weeks?
Yes. Yeah, that's a common situation we face where it seems like patients are getting the injections earlier and earlier, and other than, you know, a comment that the patient feels it's wearing off, there's not much there. Again, what should we be looking for to support doing it early?
I mean, I think the patient-reported outcome, meaning the patient actually saying, yes, I feel like it's wearing off early, is really the best indicator, because the ability of a physician to see a patient frequently enough, say, you know, every 4 to 6 weeks to actually grade them can be kind of challenging, in my opinion, and hard, especially if patients live a significant distance away and may or may not have access to telemedicine, you know, capabilities. So I don't know if that's kind of what you're looking for, but I think you really have to listen to the patients and the physicians. Patients don't want to get injected every 6 weeks if they don't need to.
Okay. All right. And do you consider botulinum toxin injections to be a first-line treatment for cervical dystonia?
Yes.
What are some of the other treatments that people might try, or is there no point in trying other treatments?
Potentially medications like muscle relaxants or benzodiazepines. But like I said earlier, all of these medications can have sedating effects or other, you know, problems that patients can encounter, versus by injecting Botox, you're specifically targeting the problem itself, meaning in the neck, and you can kind of tailor, depending on what the patient's components of cervical dystonia is, tailor it to the specific patient. Alternative to that would be something like deep brain stimulation, but that would be if botulinum toxin injections typically have failed, or for some reason if the patient could not have Botox injections for some reason.
Okay. You know, one of the things, again, that we often see is that practitioners will rotate among the different Botox preparations. Is there any benefit to doing that, or is it better to stick with one preparation for a course of therapy?
I mean, I think if the patient is reporting either earlier wearing off of the botulinum toxin, then switching brands or types is certainly reasonable, but it can be kind of challenging to have to rotate, you know, from Xeomin to Botox to Dysport back and forth because of the differences in, you know, unit dosing, meaning like, yes, Xeomin and Botox are essentially a one-to-one, you know, equivalent, but Dysport to Xeomin or Dysport to Botox is more, can be like more of like a one-to-three, meaning for every one unit of Botox brand would be roughly 3 units of Dysport. But there's, again, variable, you know, literature suggesting that can be variable. So I try to pick one and stick with it as long as the patient's getting a response, unless they're finding that they're consistently wearing off, say, at 6 or 8 weeks, then I might switch brand initially before, you know, if I can't go up higher on the dose.
Okay. Could we go to the next slide, please? I think some of these we've kind of gone over with some of our other conditions. And I'm, you know, looking at these, I don't know that there's necessarily anything new to say here. Do you think that if people give the injections, at more frequent intervals, that that plays a role in developing resistance to the injections?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Kettler. So Dr. Kettler and Dr. Kelly, Dr. Kettler, you stay on, and Dr. Chow. Dr. Pham.
Yep.
Dr. Yang and Dr. Subramanian will go on. So I apologize. I think we switched your name on the slide. So sorry about that.
That's okay.
With blepharospasm.
Okay, I guess the first two questions here are sort of related in terms of whether Botox would be a first-line treatment or other things that should be tried first and failed. And maybe I'll start with you, Dr. Pham. Could you just discuss the issue of whether there are other treatments that should be tried? Or if Botox really is the first-line treatment for blepharospasm?
I would say that Botox should be the first-line treatment. There are really no other good treatments with as much even evidence as Botox has to treat blepharospasm to be used prior to trying Botox.
Okay. Dr. Yang, do you agree?
I don't believe Dr. Yang is on, actually, so it's Dr. Subramanian and Dr. Pham only.
Oh, okay. All right. Dr. Subramanian.
Yes, I would agree. I think the evidence around using any other agent shows a lesser efficacy and a worse side effect profile, in particular any of the oral agents that have been tried. There have been good reviews of that. So I would consider botulinum toxin to be first-line therapy for patients. When we're calling it blepharospasm, we're assuming that means benign essential blepharospasm. It's prudent to look at the ocular surface and to treat any ocular surface disease for any reflex blepharospasm that may be present. But again, if it's predominantly benign essential blepharospasm, then absolutely botulinum toxin injection.
Okay. Dr. Subramanian, I'll stay with you for the next one. And again, kind of like I asked Dr. Kelly, you know, what should our reviewers look for in terms of objective criteria to determine both the effect of the injection and I guess also if the injection is wearing off and it's time for another one?
In clinical practice as well as in clinical trials, the diagnosis really is one that's made clinically. The Jankovic scale or other scales that have been developed can be used to try to assess or characterize the severity of the disease, but that's not done so much in clinical practice. We tend to characterize it by mild, moderate, or severe spasm, and those scales also don't get at functional impairment like inability to read, inability to drive, and those are, I think, criteria that are used to measure treatment benefits in individuals who are given botulinum toxin for their blepharospasm. And as far as the determination of the interval for dosing and when retreatment needs to be done, oftentimes, again, from a clinical perspective, that is done based on return of symptoms, return of difficulty with social interactions, reading and driving, and it correlates very strongly with objective observation of forceful eyelid closure and maintenance of that eyelid closure for more than a brief moment. Those two things go hand in hand. So I think when reviewers are looking at reports of a need for repeat treatment or perhaps even a shortening of the interval between treatments, those are the kind of data that are reasonable to justify repeat treatment, perhaps even increased dosing or a shorter interval between treatments.
Okay. Dr. Pham, what are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. I don't really have a whole lot to add. Basically, I think most clinicians grade some kind of spasm severity by either saying mild, moderate, or severe, or using the Jankovic scale, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus, 4 plus, and then combine that with patient reported symptoms such as photophobia, inability to read or drive, interruption of, you know, activities of daily living.
Okay. The next question, I think what that's getting at is, are there specific areas that you can support providing an injection? Should it be limited to particular areas? Again, we sometimes see where there are, you know, injections done in quite a number of places that don't always seem to make sense for the condition. Dr. Pham, I'll start with you.
So just to clarify your question, you're asking about, like, the muscles into which the toxin is being injected, or are you talking about number four here, the finite number endpoint toxin injection question?
No, I was asking about the muscles.
So if you're talking about benign essential blepharospasm, I know that the package inserts specifically say something about the orbicularis muscle. However, there's been multiple papers in the literature that talk about other sort of periocular muscles that are involved in producing the blepharospasm that's observed. So, you know, I think it's reasonable to include any and all periocular muscles that would be involved in eyelid closure, including, but perhaps not being limited to, the pretarsal orbital, precepital orbicularis, the corrugators, the procerus muscles. And, you know, there are a subset of these blepharospasm, benign essential blepharospasm patients that do demonstrate spread of spasm to, like, a Meech syndrome, or, you know, where the spasm actually starts to involve more of their lower face as well, and in which case, you know, you're going to have to start injecting some of the other muscles of the face as well to get an adequate response.
Okay. Dr. Subramanian?
I would definitely support that and say that it is a matter of individualizing the treatment for a given patient, because some patients will have very strong frontalis procerus corrugator spasms that will constrict the periocular area in such a way that it forces the eyelids closed, even if botulinum toxin is administered just to the orbicularis oculi. And if you look at studies that have been done looking at the co-activation of that entire muscle system, it is clearly involved in this dystonia. So it does need to be tailored, and as she mentioned, there are certainly numerous studies that have looked at the benefit of injecting muscles other than those of the pretarsal orbicularis oculi.
Okay. We've kind of mentioned a little bit about injections at earlier intervals than what the package insert might describe. Do most patients last for about 3 months, or are there a significant number of patients who require early injections? Dr. Subramanian?
I would say the literature, as well as my own experience, would support that the majority of patients are able to go with the standard package insert type of interval between injections, but that some individuals, particularly those who may have another predisposing factor, I have a cohort of patients with tardive dyskinesia, for example, resulting in blepharospasm, they seem to potentially require higher doses and more frequent dosing than those who truly have a essential blepharospasm.
Okay.
I have similar sort of findings where the majority of patients, you know, do fine with the standard interval and standard dosing, but there's a subset of patients, not only in the literature but also in my clinical practice, I would say up to 25% that would benefit from either more frequent dosing or higher dosing.
Do you think that more frequent dosing predisposes to resistance?
No.
Okay.
No, I've not observed that either.
Okay.
And the literature doesn't back that up either. There was a recent meta-analysis of development of neutralizing antibodies in patients getting toxin, and ultimately the rate of antibody formation was incredibly low. And in addition, of those patients that developed antibodies, most of them actually, it did not make them resistant to toxin effect. So there is, you know, based off of that, I would say there's very little risk and little clinical significance to those.
Okay. All right. You know, I guess a question I would ask the two of you as well is the issue of switching amongst the different preparations. Is that a good thing, a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
I can start on that. There have been head-to-head studies that have been published showing that you generally don't need to switch, but if you do switch between, in particular, onabotulinum toxin, incobotulinum toxin, that the effect in a given patient does tend to be pretty equivalent. Switching is, like in the other conditions we've talked about, generally done if there's a concern that there may be a decrease in efficacy, and there is some literature to suggest that switching can restore response to the medication. But I would say that it is not necessary in many patients, but it occurs for various reasons that may have something to do with a clinical issue or something to do with the administrative issue.
Okay, Dr. Pham?
I agree. Nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kettler, Dr. Pham, and Dr. Subramanian, but you guys are going to continue with strabismus.
Okay. And I guess I'll start with Dr. Pham then. Is there evidence to support botulinum toxin injections as a first-line treatment for strabismus?
So I'll say the short answer is yes. However, I think there's a couple of weaknesses here, which is, number one, there's very few like large-scale level one studies on it. Number two, most of what's out there is on a very specific type of strabismus, which is a concomitant non-paratic non-restrictive etiology. Which really doesn't encompass all potential indications and etiologies of strabismus, right? So there's, you know, restrictive strabismuses, there's acute acquired paralytic strabismus, there's, you know, consecutive postoperative strabismus, there are like neuromuscular strabismus, neurogenic, iatrogenic strabismus. So, you know, the medium answer is it likely depends on the etiology of the strabismus and really the primary, like the clinical goal or endpoint that's desired with the use of the toxin.
Okay. Dr. Subramanian?
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is that there is some evidence for using it in the treatment of acquired acute paralytic strabismus to increase functionality in the short term. May not affect long-term outcomes, and as Dr. Pham said, the vast differences amongst the conditions and the fact that sometimes when we're talking about most of the studies actually being done in a pediatric population as opposed to an adult population, there are different considerations around using botulinum toxin as first line versus some other therapy such as surgery or optical devices.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And also, I wrote some notes down here that there, I did find a one level two study that indicates actually better outcomes with Botox or with botulinum toxin in kids with a partially accommodative esotropia or a high ACA ratio esotropia. And so specifically for that indication, there's definitely some evidence that says that botulinum toxin would be a good first line treatment for that.
Okay. All right. I think we've really covered question two then in part of answering question one. I think that covers it. Thank you both. Ola, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay. You're not going to go through any of the general questions at all, or you're good with
it? It seems like we've covered them. I guess I'll ask our experts, is there any of these questions that would be different for strabismus than conditions we've discussed already?
I would say that one difference is that if you look at the evidence and treatment strategies around botulinum toxin for strabismus versus the dystonias like we've been talking about, the number of injections that are delivered is typically going to be far fewer for strabismus than for other conditions, because if you are temporizing a patient with an acute acquired condition that may ultimately resolve, then the botulinum toxin is useful with one or two injections. And similarly, the literature around childhood strabismus suggests that some patients may respond to a single therapeutic injection of botulinum toxin, whereas others may require repeat therapy. So there are some different issues around dosing and interval that have to be determined clinically by the treating physician.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There is a potential for an endpoint, you know, particularly if you're trying to treat a, you know, like a acute paralytic etiology that might resolve eventually. There, you know, I think the difference here is that there might actually be an endpoint to treatments at some point.
Okay, thank you. Ola?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Kettler, Dr. Pham, and Dr. Subramanian. And before we move on to the next one, Dr. Frizzandi joined us, and I would like to have her check out her audio just to make sure everything's good before she gets to her topic. So, Dr. Frizzandi, could you please introduce yourself?
Oh,
tell us your
sure. Can you
affiliation? Your affiliation
you
and any. Yeah, we can hear you. And any conflicts of interest if they exist. Thank you.
Sure. I've been on the entire time since 10:30. There's been something wrong with the audio. So I'm Tanas Frizzandi. I'm the University of Southern California urogynecologist. And along with Dr. Amy Park, representing the American College of OBGYN and also the American Urogynecological Society, I have no conflicts of interest.
Thank you, Dr. Frizzandi. Okay, we'll go on with the meeting to chronic migraine prophylaxis with Dr. Moynihan, Drs. Montes and Knight. So, Dr. Moynihan, over to you.
Hi.
Yes,
great.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think because we have a bunch of questions for this one, I'm going to ask one of you to answer first and then the other to add to it and maybe alternate that, starting with Dr. Montes. Is there evidence to support treatment or treatments prior to using botulinum toxin injections for chronic migraine prophylaxis?
There's really not. It's not. There's no evidence for step therapy for using onobotulinum toxin A for treatment of chronic migraine. There may be financial reasons, cost savings reasons. There are a number of other therapeutics that have efficacy for chronic migraine, topiramate, which does have a significant adverse profile. Anti-CGRP monoclonal antibodies, there are four out on the market to the ligand or to the receptor, as well as atogepant, a gepant. These are the data. Generally speaking, insurance requires trials of oral therapies that have very little evidence for chronic migraine, which is more burdensome and associated with more headache days.
Thank you. Dr. Knight, do you have anything to add?
I agree with the statement. I would just add that when you look at the research, the Botox is pretty equivalent to other by-mouth medications that are on the market and even the injectables. And the thing is that when you look at the studies, the drop out of patients on a lot of the by-mouth medications is pretty significant. And so I really agree that it should be considered head-to-head with other possible treatments.
I'm not sure I understood that comment. There's very little evidence for the oral therapeutics for treatment of chronic migraine.
No.
With the exception of topiramate.
Yeah, no, but what I'm saying is, and amitriptyline is also one that we see in the literature. But what I'm saying is
not for chronic migraine.
Not for chronic. But Topamax, still, if you look at the studies, the dropout rate of people on Topamax compared to Botox is pretty significant.
I agree.
When you look at the actual studies.
Absolutely. So the problem is the tolerability of topiramate. Is problematic for many patients.
Correct.
Thank you. Starting with Dr. Knight, is there evidence that supports the need for concurrent use of other medications in addition to botulinum toxin injections for chronic migraine?
Yes, actually, there are actually some nice studies that are coming out now, specifically with Botox along with the CGRP medication. Using them concurrent and showing that there is more efficacy with the two of them together. So I definitely think that there is some evidence that in the literature that is supporting concurrent treatments.
I agree with that. And in addition, it makes biologic sense because they have different mechanisms of action.
Yep.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Monteith, does the evidence point to specific criteria that should be used to measure the treatment benefits and outcomes of chronic migraine prophylaxis with botulinum toxin?
I think that we need to think about patient-centric approaches, and the issue is that some patients may respond in terms of headache days, 50% responder rates, but other patients may respond in a reduction in moderate to severe days that might be significant for them. Some patients may have the same number of total headache days or migraine days, but there's a 30% reduction in pain intensity. So I think that you have to look at a number of patient-reported outcomes to determine whether it's efficacious or not, because we know migraine is a heterogeneous disorder and patients may respond in different ways.
Dr. Knight, anything to add to that?
No, that was well put.
Okay, Dr. Knight, is there evidence to support at least a 50% reduction in mean headache days per month when using botulinum toxin for chronic migraine?
Yes, there is. I think there's plenty of evidence now, whether it be PRAMS or other studies, that definitely does show this.
Anything to add, Dr. Monteith?
Yeah, I think a 50% responder rate is an important outcome measure, and it's something that we're trying to look at across therapeutics. But if patients have 30% response rate for specific patients, that might mean keeping their job versus not keeping their job.
Understood. So, Dr. Monteith, knowing that FDA reviewed the PREEMPT study's results and only approved onabotulinum toxin A at 155 units, is there robust evidence demonstrating that more than 155 units of onabotulinum toxin A is clinically superior and more effective when treating chronic migraine?
For patients that are non-responders to 155 units, it makes clinical sense to increase the dose to 195 units, and that's done in other countries or European colleagues. And there's a number of observational studies that have shown that follow the pain, larger dose may actually provide a better response rate.
Dr. Knight?
I agree. Even in the PREEMPT trial, they actually did allow for an extra 40 units, and they were following the pain. And when you look at the results, they're saying that it's just as safe and as well tolerated. So we need to treat our patients for their needs, and we should have the availability to be able to provide that, especially when research is saying that there's no need not to.
Thanks. Dr. Knight, knowing the FDA reviewed the PREEMPT results and only approved onabotulinum toxin A to be administered every 12 weeks, is there robust evidence demonstrating that less or fewer than 12 weeks dosing of onabotulinum toxin A is clinically superior and more effective for treating chronic migraines?
So I think we kind of covered this a little bit, because the question of the 12 weeks really has to do whether over time there's any reduction in the efficacy if we go to the less than 12 weeks. But a lot of the research is showing that is not the case. And I think it's just a very individual thing, because there are a lot of patients who will come to you who are winding up running out of the efficacy of the medication sooner. So I think that the literature is really showing us and speaking to the idea that there is not necessarily the reason not to administer every has to be on point at every 12 weeks, and always thinking about doing the most effective for the patient.
Dr. Monteith, anything to add to that?
Yes, I agree with this statement that every 12 weeks is an average. There are patients that require more frequent injections because there is wearing off. So while there's not randomized clinical trials comparing every 8 weeks, every 12 weeks for chronic migraine patients, there's a number of real-world and clinic-based studies that are consistent with, I think, a clinical experience that wearing off can be significant at it's for some patients as early as 8 weeks, other patients as early as 10 weeks, and so that more frequent dosing may be indicated for certain patients without the concern of increased adverse events.
Thank you. For this condition, what might determine a safe dosing range? Just the studies or?
Dosing range or frequency?
Yeah.
Dosing range.
Yeah, so we don't really, I mean, that's a great question. It would be nice if we had predictors. We don't have predictors, so it's really based on lack of efficacy, and I think it's based on lack of efficacy, and there may be other things that people may consider, but generally speaking, it's lack of efficacy. If a patient doesn't respond to 155 units, it makes sense to increase to 195. And again, in some clinical practices, they go straight to the 195.
Absolutely.
I would just also like to add that the earlier studies, the complication rates of using onabotulinum toxin A for treatment of chronic migraine seems to have been much higher, neck pain. I think that they've, over time, the field has done a good job of learning the best practices for injecting both small muscles and large muscles and preventing some of those complications. So it's really not much of a concern. And also identifying patients that have pre-existing weakness that you wouldn't want to go higher on.
Okay, thank you. Is there any evidence considering chronic migraines to support any limitations of treatment duration for this condition? And what I mean is, could you control it so well, let's say even with a combination therapy, that you then drop out of the definition of chronic migraine? Or would you say that chronically treating the patient, once you make that diagnosis, you're always going to treat it? I hope that's
a great question. I don't know who you want to take that question, but it's a great question.
You can both take a stab at it.
I feel like that's what we're doing. We're taking a stab at it.
Yeah.
There are clearly patients that have, and then we have to look at the analogies, a depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, a patient that has schizophrenia that's on antipsychotic medications and is no longer having hallucinations, are, you know, psychotic, does that person still have schizophrenia? Yes. And so the problem with chronic migraine, and some people even beyond the scope of this call debate that chronic migraine should exist, that migraine is just migraine, and there's higher frequencies of migraine and lower frequencies of migraine. Having said that, we don't have a way to gauge whether you pull the medicine away, whether they will relapse back to that higher frequency, or as we know that migraine is also a relapsing, remitting kind of condition where patients can go through periods of doing well even without medication and doing worse. So we don't really have a way of knowing when we stop these medicines. There's certainly people and possibly indicators that you could hold medication on a patient, and if their frequency increases, restart the treatment. But there's no way to guide that decision-making.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think that, you know, that's one of the things working with our patients to be able to recognize if they have reentered into their migraine patterns, because there are a lot of different things that can cause that to happen. So I completely agree.
Thank you. Is there evidence to support using a different botulinum serotype interchangeably in the absence of an individual FDA approval for this condition?
There's not evidence. There may be places where access is an issue, but we really don't have evidence to support the use of other neurotoxins for treatment of chronic migraine. That may change because I'm aware, and it's in the public space, of other, trials coming down the line. But we just don't have the evidence.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Did you want to say something and add to that, Dr. Knight? I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I disagree.
Okay. I'm guessing the answer to the role of antibody testing is the same for this as it was for the other conditions. It's not something that you necessarily need to do, or?
Yeah.
It is similar. It's not going to make a difference, as we had talked about before, in migraine versus some of these other treatments using Botox.
I heard you mention that if the patient already was somewhat weak, you might not want to use this approach to treatment, but what are the contraindications that exist for the use of botulinum toxin in this entity?
Well, besides like motor weakness, of course, you'd also, like, if somebody has some major skin issues, you know, those are not areas that you would be injecting Botox into. If you already had somebody not only like who also had swallowing issues, talking issues, breathing issues, you know, any, of course, allergy to Botox and stuff like that. So those would truly be limiting factors. But it wouldn't, if you had skin conditions, it doesn't mean that Botox could not be used in areas where you did not have such inflammatory skin issues.
Anything to add to that, Dr. Monti?
So neuromuscular disorders, neuromuscular junction disorders specifically, not just like general weakness. And I agree, if there's like a herpetic lesion, you may not want to inject. If there's someone that has an active Bell's palsy that's an acute, you may not want to inject. But there's very little contraindications to injecting.
Absolutely.
Are there long-term effects of botulism toxin in this entity of chronic migraine?
It's not well captured. I mean, there's certainly potential cosmetic side effects that most patients don't mind, surprisingly. You know, for example, temporalis muscle can look thin, and that can be cosmetically unpleasing. But beyond that, no.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think this concludes this section, unless any of the other medical directors have any additional questions.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Moynihan. I do have one little thing to add in terms of questioning. When we're talking about evidence to support at least 50% reduction in the mean headache days per month, is it reasonable to expect, what kind of documentation is one to expect in a note concerning the nature of the headaches that the patient is having, you know, to support the fact that it is migraineous as opposed to other types of headache? So is there any evidence, or what kind of documentation should we expect to see in the chart?
So the standard documentation requirements is usually a history of chronic migraine, and, you know, we use International Classification of Headache Disorders now in its third edition, but, you know, it's a clinical diagnosis, so it might not go by that strict classification. But in order to meet the standards would be 15 headache days for at least 3 months, at least 4 hours in duration. So that's the standard documentation, and it's clinical. It's by clinical report. The 50% responder rate, while great, is not the only outcome that might be important to the patient or of value to the patient. So their disability scales like MIDAS that are sometimes used, patient diary information that is used, there's patient migraine-specific quality of life that can be used. So there are a number of indicators, and I think the patient simply saying they're better, a reduction in analgesic use is another example. So I wouldn't fixate on a 50% responder rate as the sole kind of outcome measure.
I agree with that too. You know, quality of life is extremely important, and sometimes that 50% doesn't really get to that point of life quality as it could be.
It could also be associated symptoms. Patient can have less nausea and vomiting.
Yep.
You know, and so migraine, we know, is more than just a headache, and that there are these associated symptoms that matter as well.
Ola, are you still there?
Yes.
Sorry, I was saying thank you very much. Thank you, Eileen. I had gone on mute while they were talking. I was saying, and it would be reasonable to expect, rather than just seeing something like patient had only 5 headaches this month or something, it would be reasonable to expect a character, you know, the character of the headaches that the patient did have in the chart.
Well, I think if a patient went from 15 to 5, that's significant. The more, as a researcher, the more documentation, the better, but we don't always get that. But I think that if you go from 15 to 5, that's a massive reduction, over 50% response for sure. So I don't think you necessarily need that.
Okay, so then the last question I have is, so let's say this has happened, you know, the patient keeps consistently having, let's say, 5 headaches, right, and has been getting it every 12 weeks. Is there literature, you know, to support or prolonging when a trial of prolonging the interval? You know, we talked before about the reduction in interval, but is there literature to support prolonging the interval, so longer than 12 weeks?
Yeah, so there's really not. If for some patients, this is just in my clinical practice, I may have one or two that have had like 2 migraines per month, and we said, okay, well, let's stretch it out, and let's see if we can wean you off and what happens, and, you know, let's see if you can go 4 months, because they hate the needle, so some people, and they're happy to go those 4, and for some patients that might work, but there's really not clinical guidance to support doing that.
Okay.
No, there isn't.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. So next is myself and Dr. Gwali, and we're going to be talking about anal fissure. So Dr. Gwali, are you unmuted?
Yes. Ready,
okay.
Ready to go.
All right. So is there any evidence to support the use of botulinum toxin injections as first-line treatment for anal fissure?
There actually is not. Anal fissure and the use of botulinum toxin is a little different from the other uses that we have talked about. So anal fissures develop when there is some trauma to the anal canal, and the most common mechanism of that trauma is heart stool passing through. Once there is that trauma, since that area is extremely sensitive and there are sensory nerves, the response, there are two elements that happen in the response. First is pain, if there is pain when stool passes through. The second is a reflex spasm of the sphincter muscle, usually the internal, but sometimes the external as well. Botulinum toxin is used to blunt that spasm. Sometimes the spasm can cause pain. So clearly, it isn't necessary in every patient. Most anal fissures heal on their own if the stool is made soft so that it can pass through and the patient doesn't have to strain or have a lot of discomfort while allowing the stool to move through. So most anal fissures will heal with stool softeners and laxatives, and sometimes use of topical muscle relaxants like nitroglycerin cream or calcium blockers that can be applied in the form of creams once in a while. Topical analgesic containing creams can be applied to the anal canal. There are commercial preparations that have lidocaine and steroids in them. The vast, vast majority of anal fissures heal with these treatments. Once in a while, the spasm is counterproductive, or the pain is counterproductive in that the patient isn't able to evacuate stool because of how tight the muscle is going to close the lumen. And in those situations, botulinum toxin injection can help reverse that consequence of the presence of the spasm. So the short answer is there is no evidence to use botulinum toxin as the first line of treatment for anal fissure.
Okay, and I think you kind of answered question two as well in terms of the treatments that should be tried prior to using botulinum toxin injection for anal fissure. Do you have anything else to add to that?
The only additional comment I would make regarding this is that sometimes the botulinum toxin helps with the pain of defecation. And so if there is significant pain with defecation, despite all the other measures, that by itself may escalate the need to use the botulinum toxin a little earlier in the management. Not necessarily first line, but a little earlier in the management.
Okay, thank you. So is there evidence to continue the use of botulinum toxin injections after the first two injections in anal fissures?
There is no good evidence for a long-term or a repetitive injection pattern in that setting, because if the muscle remains in spasm and the fissure persists, there could be one of two possibilities. The first is that there is some other mechanism for the fissure, like the patient has Crohn's disease or some other reason for the fissure, and that needs to be investigated. The second is the fact that not every patient responds to botulinum toxin, and that patient could be a non-responder. If you look at the literature, anywhere from 20 to 50% may not respond. And so a decision will have to be made after two or three injections as to whether management needs to escalate to a sphincterotomy or a fissurotomy, depending on what the fissure looks like to the surgeon. The only exception to the rule probably is going to be the pain patient. The patient with pain who has a very noticeable improvement in pain after botulinum toxin injection, and the pain recurs, because pain by itself can lead to recurrence or propagation of the fissure, just because of how pain can create a situation of obstipation. And the longer stool stays inside, the harder it gets. So it gets into this vicious cycle of the patient not wanting to defecate, stool becomes hard, and when they eventually defecate, that tears up the fissure a little bit more. So that may be the one situation where it might make sense, especially if the fissure was healing or moving the right direction, to repeat an injection past the first two if there was a positive response to the earlier injections.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to move on to general questions. I think I just have a couple. They're intertwined. So is there robust literature to support using a different dose or a different frequency than the one approved by FDA?
The literature is all over the place in terms of dose and frequency. And so if the question is there hard evidence to support a fixed frequency, injection frequency, there isn't, or a fixed dose, there isn't. Doses anywhere from a total of 50 to 100 units have been used. And it seems the response is not necessarily different when doses higher than 100 units have been used. So I would say that the appropriate dose is somewhere between 50 and 100 units in divided doses. There is also no consensus in where exactly to inject. Most people agree that it's the internal sphincter that needs to be targeted, either anteriorly or posteriorly. Some people inject into the fissure, some people inject next to the fissure. The response seems to be the same regardless of where the injection is made.
Okay, thank you. And the last one is there evidence to support using a different botulinum serotype interchangeably in the absence of individual FDA approval for the same for anal fissures?
I think there is no evidence to suggest that that approach would not work. So I'm answering your question in the reverse.
The other way,
It'll probably work, but there is no comparative studies. It might be reasonable to change the brand if the expected results are not reached, but it can't be supported with any of the evidence that I've reviewed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think that's all, unless you have any other thing that you wanted to say about this.
I don't have anything more to say, but thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bialawi. All right. So coming up next is intravesical analgesia by Dr. Lovelace and Dr. Park.
Hello. Then we'll move into how are you? All right. So what evidence, if any, supports the use of botulism toxin injections for the off-label use for interstitial cystitis and or bladder pain?
So there are studies that look at this interstitial cystitis and bladder pain, and Botox is definitely a part of the algorithm for this. Interstitial cystitis, one of the characteristics is reduced compliance. So Botox, by relaxing the detrusor muscle, does help with the urgency frequency component of it.
And how about evidence for the use for off-label use for intravesicular vesical analgesia?
This question I'm not quite sure of, because the intravesical analgesia in my mind is administering things like intravesical lidocaine or administering heparin. So I think it does help with the bladder pain aspect. If that's what the question is.
Yeah, I think it's asking, is there any role for injection of Botox for the analgesia,
analgesia component for IC, not necessarily the just filling the bladder with the lidocaine heparin modality.
Okay. Yes, there's the thing about the the botulinum toxin is that it does affect the afferents supply because, you know, if you look at, for instance, the overactive bladder and neurogenic bladder literature, the urgency frequency component is really like an afferent sensation problem. So it does have these effects in terms of modulating the pain and the urgency component.
And is there any evidence that it would support its use in that, or is it more of a experimental trying to figure out if it would benefit at this phase?
This is a something that I know is many protocols are dedicated to using the botulinum toxin for the interstitial cystitis. Usually those are performed in the operating room due to the patient's discomfort with just any kind of distension, bladder distension.
Okay, thank you. And I believe you're going to be staying on for the next set of questions.
So, Meredith, Dr. Lovelace, do you want to wait till, do you think the general questions
can wait.
Kind of be lumped together? Okay. All right. So we'll move on to the next set. Yep. And we'll have Dr. Frizzandi join to answer our neurogenic bladder.
Great.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome, Dr. Frizzandi. The next question is there evidence to support the use of botulinum toxin as a first-line treatment for neurogenic or overactivity bladder?
So there aren't any clear trials talking about that specifically, but when you look at most of the trials and also just clinical practice in general, I think a lot of people feel that using Botox in patients who have severe detrusor overactivity and have the underlying condition of neurogenic bladder, that they feel like it is the most efficacious. And so there are studies that have obviously, most of the studies are done in adult men, but there are some pediatric studies as well. And even those have shown high rates of efficacy over their long term. Yeah. And when you look at patient satisfaction, et cetera, those also follow suit.
Thank you. And what treatments, if any, would be considered failures prior to the use of botulism toxin injection? I think what the question's really getting at is, you know, what, we asked if it was first line, when would it be used as a second or third line option in the management of this condition?
Yeah, so it's interesting. When you look at some of the data, though, a lot of these, there's a confounder, right? Because a lot of these patients have been tried on anticholinergics, more so that the beta-3s that we have available. So a lot of these patients in the trials also were tried on anticholinergics. And I think in clinical practice, you will see that because a lot of times we are kind of driven to do that before we get approval for Botox in these patients. So, again, I wouldn't necessarily say that we need to see these failures because a lot of us would feel that moving forward quickly is better for the patient, especially in our neurogenic patients who already have issues with recurring UTIs and more so with retention as their primary, you know, kind of qualifying symptoms.
And then you've already answered question three, but are there any guidelines that provide recommendations in this area? And then my other question was, is there issues with, when you mentioned the retention, is it, you know, what preparation or what considerations do you need to make in terms of if they have retention exacerbated by the botulism?
Sure. I think that's where you have to kind of look at the guidelines and then look at the clinical scenario. So, yes, there are guidelines from most of the societies that kind of work in this space talking about how Botox can be used in the therapy algorithm. I think when you talk about retention, most of these patients already have retention. And so when we talk about a lot of the studies look at either 200 versus 300 units used in the neurogenic bladder population, And so the retention rate is higher in those patients anyway, but most of these patients are already self-catheterizing. And so what we're trying to do is ameliorate the symptoms of severe detrusor overactivity where they're having leakage and, you know, the quality of life is pretty abysmal. So I think all of these questions kind of get smelted into one, frankly. And so there is a lot of evidence in relation to the Botox for this population. And then interestingly, you know, whether you use 200 versus 300 units, there isn't any robust evidence to say one dose is better than the other, but generally we start at 200 and some people will go to 300, but the clinical data doesn't necessarily support the 300 dose. And then there is some evidence to show that over the long term, at least in the pediatric population, there is a waning effect of efficacy after, you know, multiple years of using this.
I'm just going to jump in here and just say, this is Dr. Park. You know, there are AUA guidelines regarding using the botulinum toxin. So, and I do think that the 200 and 300 dose has been extensively studied in this setting. And I know that it's clinically, I know there's always questions about the off-label use that some people even are using 400.
15. Yeah. And then, well, are we moving to the next set on the overactive bladder, or?
Yeah, I think we have three sections that we possibly could just kind of combine and see what that might be more efficient.
So, Stephanie, could you advance the slides, please?
Great, thank you. And so this will include both Dr. Frizzandi and Dr. Park. And so the first question is there any off-label use for the botulism toxin for overactive bladder? And if so, please describe. So this would be beyond what's already been established and acceptable, you know, labeled use.
So this is Dr. Park. I was just going to say that one thing that I, reading the packet insert, that, and I think that the other panelists can also speak to this, but the dosage is technically, according to the insert, is not to exceed 400 units in 3 months. I will say that speaking with my neurology colleagues, they exceed this limit all the time, especially in the neurogenic population. It's the timing of these doses in those patients who have multiple sclerosis and are getting their muscles injected. It's usually a high dose. And I think clinically there's not really been any evidence of untoward effects as they exceed these limits all the time. I will say that although the FDA guidelines for the overactive bladder dosage is officially 100 units. Dose escalation to 200 units has excellent results for those patients who have experienced partial or lack of response. I'm just going to refer to this randomized controlled trial by Dr. Amundsen et al. Called the Rosetta trial, and that randomized patients with refractory overactive bladder to botulinum toxins 200 units versus sacral neuromodulation. And this showed that they were equivalent. So there's definitely, this was published in JAMA in 2016. So there's definitely evidence to support the use of 200 units in idiopathic detrusor overactivity. And like I alluded to before, there's, for neurogenic, there's definitely multiple studies looking at 200 and 300 units for neurogenic detrusor overactivity.
Thank you very much, and also for the references. And the next set of questions are all really aiming at the same thing. Who's the right patient for Botox for overactive bladder? So if we could go back to the overactive bladder slide, please. Thank you. And so we're looking at, you know, what treatment should have been, is typically done prior to moving to botulism for treatment. Is there any evidence or established algorithms for that? And then also Is there a certain number of medications and classes that should be tried? So we're really trying to look here at patient selection.
So this is Kazandi. I mean, I think it's really important to kind of break this down. You know, we have these algorithms that have been published, and I think a lot of people tend to follow them. I think it's really important for our clinicians to do the baseline treatments, and that is understanding behavior. When we start throwing these medications and interventions at our patients, but, you know, they are excessively caffeinated or they're drinking literally gallons of water a day, we're not going to be overriding it. So I think the practical way of addressing this is to do the conservative management and behavior management. If they have failed that, and if you know your patients, and if they've really failed that, then I tend to be a little bit more aggressive. I tend to look at the patient kind of in total. If I have an elderly patient who's already on multiple medications, and she can barely keep dry at night, she's waking up, all of these things that are detriment to her overall well-being. We don't want her falling at night, et cetera. You kind of take that whole person in perspective. And I tend to be a little bit more aggressive in trying to get them to Botox. We have other modalities available, which are nerve stimulators, but you have to kind of gauge whether or not the cost and the time that it takes to get these patients on board versus being able to offer them something in the office that is very low risk and very efficacious. And if I need to repeat a dose, I can do that as well. So I think when we look at, like, questions 2, 3, et cetera, I hesitate because a lot of times we feel like our hands are tied having to follow the step-by-step-by-step process when we know that perhaps moving them along that algorithm would be beneficial to them.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add that the AUA SUFU guidelines do say that recommend behavioral modifications, oral antimuscarinic, beta-3 agonists. And, but there are so many, the anti-muscarinics or anti-cholinergics are problematic for those patients who are elderly, have polypharmacy. There's an associated risk of increased risk of dementia with the use of anti-cholinergic medications. And then concern about gastric emptying because of the slowing of the bowels, like gastroparesis, et cetera. So there's definitely, and overactive bladder is very common in this patient population. So I think that there is, regarding needing to try medications prior to proceeding with Botox in those populations can be problematic and cause more issues. It is also an issue for those who are, the elderly also have a lot of polypharmacy. Regarding mixed urinary incontinence, I would definitely say that, the urge tends to be more bothersome. So we use patient-guided decision-making to counsel them. If they choose to address their urge with a botulinum, it's a very efficacious therapy, as all of the other panelists have alluded to.
5 minutes.
Thank you. And our final question in this area is, again, dealing with patient selection, but you just addressed some of the concerns with the medication and potential effects it may have in this population. Are there any concerns directly related to the use of the botulinum toxin, such anything that you might consider a relative or absolute contraindication in this population or higher risk for failure to respond?
Anyone
As the previously alluded to by the panelists, the patients with like muscle weakness disorders like myasthenia gravis, Lambert-Eaton syndrome, we should exercise caution. I think that clinicians just also need to be careful about patients who have a history of diabetes or those with a history of recurrent UTIs. I will say patients who have recurrent UTIs tend to get UTIs regardless, just maybe having extra care regarding the peri-procedure antibiotic prophylaxis is helpful.
And I think I'll add that you have to be thoughtful about patients who are all right anticoagulated and how comfortable you feel doing these injections in the clinic versus in an outpatient center. I think those are just more logistical and operational things. It's not a contraindication, however.
Thanks. Appreciate your answer. And I believe that concludes our this section. Oh, we got the urinary incontinence. And then the evidence regarding the use of botulism toxin for urinary incontinence and the quality of that evidence.
There are several RCTs looking at the use of botulinum toxin for urinary incontinence. I alluded to the Rosetta trial looking at botulinum versus thicker neuromodulation. The one prior to that, I think it's from 2012 in the New England Journal of Medicine, was the ABC trial, and this was performed by Dr. Visco et al. Basically showed that botulinum toxin is efficacious and results in the complete resolution of urge incontinence in a high proportion of women, about a third of women, as opposed to about 13% in those patients taking anticholinergics.
And would your comments regarding conservative treatment and number of medications be any different for urinary incontinence than it was for overactive bladder, or do you feel that you would utilize the same approach in this population?
Well, urinary incontinence is... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that, again, we have to kind of deal with that clinically, because one of the challenges that we have, and we have a lot of data to support this, you know, including the RCT, is that a lot of patients self-discontinue a lot of their medications in relation to their urinary incontinence, primarily because of side effect profile. And so often what we realize is that the patients drop off, and then they keep kind of repeating the cycle, and then they keep coming back into the clinics, et cetera. And so I think trying to manage these patients in a more expeditious fashion, it is better to perhaps even try one or two medications, but in general, moving them down the algorithmic pathway sooner than later, because there is a huge burden on the system. And I work, part of my time is at a government institution at a county hospital, and I see patients that are churning and churning and churning, not getting care for weeks, if not months, and sometimes even years, before that, you know, something like Botox is offered them, which we can offer in the clinic. So I think we just have to kind of look at these guidelines and these algorithms, but then kind of individualize them to the clinical situation and scenario in front of us, along with the age of the patient, the ability for them to carry financial burdens, and also logistically how much time is spent going through these algorithmic processes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I will say that the conservative therapy and behavioral modifications can help, but for those patients with severe symptoms, it's in my experience, it doesn't really help. So, having to consider place patients on meds that are lowly likelihood of making a dent. It's discouraging, but also regarding costs, there's lots of data showing that the anticholinergic refill rate at 1 year is very low. The efficacy is also low, and the out-of-pocket cost and overall cost with Botox is lower overall than using the meds. In particular, when you look at the higher cost meds.
Yeah, and I think to piggyback onto what Amy's saying is that the other thing is that we have other options, the neuromodulators, But when you look at the efficacy of, say, posterior tibial nerve stimulation, which falls into the same tier during in the algorithms, versus sacral nerve modulation, the cost is astronomically high when you talk about nerve modulation, the sacral version. And then while the cost to posterior tibial nerve stimulation is far less, the time burden is pretty excessive where patients have to come to the clinic for several weeks at a time, and then the efficacy in itself doesn't match that of Botox. So I think, you know, we're also here advocating for kind of loosening the reins on some of these tiered algorithms that kind of hold us back from offering what we need to for our patients.
Thank you. And I think we concluded our section just in time. I appreciate your participation.
Thank you very, very
Thank
much.
You.
So next we have Dr. Moynihan, laryngeal dystonia, and that will be with Dr. Garrett.
Dr. Garrett, what evidence, if any, supports use of botulism off-label for laryngeal dystonia?
So botulinum toxin for laryngeal dystonia, which historically has been called spasmodic dysphonia, as you see in the title. I mean, I think there's more than 30 years evidence that supports its use. And it, you know, I think there are just innumerable references, only a very few that were included in your list.
What treatments, if any, would be considered failures prior to using the botulinum toxin injections for spasmodic dysphonia?
So, you know, botulinum toxin is really the first-line treatment. In general, you know, if you think about what other treatments are available, it's you know, behavioral modifications with speech therapy, oral medications, and potential surgery, and there's no question that botulinum toxin, direct botulinum toxin injections into the affected laryngeal muscles is first line. So yeah. I would not consider any other treatment prior.
Is there evidence as to whether botulinum toxin should be used to treat abductor laryngeal dystonia in addition to the adductor type?
So, I mean, again, it's just a different muscle group. You know, for the adductor type, it's the thyroarytenoid muscle and lateral crecoarytenoid muscle complex. And for abductor, it's the posterior crecoarytenoid muscle. Botox has been shown to be efficacious for both. The issue with abductor is that the PCA muscles are a little bit tougher to access, especially in the office. But I think there's plenty of evidence that supports its use for both types.
Does the literature support the use of targeting injections using modalities such as vision and palpation versus electromyographic guidance, nerve stimulation, or ultrasound?
So I'm not aware of any studies that specifically compare the different modalities. I think it's very physician specific. I would say that the majority of physicians who do these injections, which are primarily otolaryngologists and even within that laryngologists, I think the majority of us use EMG guidance. There is a small subset that may use indirect vision through flexible transnasal laryngoscopy, and some, you know, I'm not even aware specifically of anyone who uses ultrasound or nerve stimulation. You're really just recording. So it's, you know, these muscles are a little bit tougher to get to than some of the other areas that we've been talking about in this webinar, but I think the physician wants to use the right modality to get them to the right muscle, and I think the most of it's just EMG.
Thank you. What criteria or scales should be used to measure the outcomes, such as perceptual voice quality measures, quality of life measures, such as the voice handicap index or the voice related NIA?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah,
I think patient-reported outcomes is the standard to evaluate the efficacy, and I think it should be physician preference. Some people, you know, typically use the VHI. Some people use the VRQOL. For me, I think the surrogate for a patient-reported outcome survey is that the patients return for their subsequent injections, because honestly, from a quality of life standpoint, they depend on their voice. If it weren't working, they would not come back.
Is there any evidence to support any limitations of treatment durations for this condition? Like, if this didn't work, you should do something else? Or?
So, I mean, I think first of all, for this disorder, the botulinum toxin injections is primary. You know, beyond that, there are other surgical options that are considered. Very few people get response with the oral medications for this. I think that the question and the nuances of this treatment approach, though, is very patient-dependent. And I think some of the questions are going to be related to dose response. But, you know, I think, you know, I have patients that I inject with 0.1 units, and I have patients that need, you know, greater than 5 units for each injection. And there's really no way to predict where each person is going to fall. And so there is a little bit of trial and error at the beginning. We typically would start with a standard dose and see how they do. You have to weigh the side effect profile versus the improvement profile for each person.
Is there evidence to support using different botulinum serotypes interchangeably for this?
If you look at most of the studies, I mean, the large majority are done with onobotulinum toxin. This is, you know, one where we are using such small amounts of units that, you know, we're not typically concerned about antibody formation. I think some of my colleagues do use a different form of the onobotulinum toxin because of their hospital preferences in purchasing. So I think, you know, sticking with different forms of onobotulinum toxin is probably the predominant type.
Are there contraindications for the use of botulinum toxin in this entity?
Not specifically, no.
Are there long-term effects of using it? Let's say if somebody couldn't have a surgical procedure or whatever.
Can you be more specific with a surgical procedure?
No, I just wanted to know, if you had to use it long-term, would there be any long-term effects of using it?
No. I've been treating some of the same patients for over 25 years, and they still get effects, and we're not seeing any dose escalation as well. So we have not been concerned with that. There are certainly short-term side effects that we see, and that's where we have to balance the dose response because, again, each patient is different, and the frequency of injections is different. I think that's one question that I'm not sure you asked that, or I guess it's under number three. I think that the dosing intervals, quite frankly, need to be looked at as each patient's response because everybody's voice demands are different. You know, this is a functional type problem, and you know, some people need to come back much more often than every 12 weeks, and some don't come back for 4 to 6 months. So there should not be a prescribed limit to how often or how much we give.
Okay, thank you. I think this concludes this section, unless anyone else has questions of Dr. Garrett.
Thanks, Dr. Moynihan. So you will stay on, and Dr. Kelly will join you as you discuss the Sialorrhea.
Hi. Is there evidence regarding the use of botulinum toxin for chronic Sialorrhea?
So this is Dr. Kelly. I would say definitively yes. Injections into the submandibular and parotid glands have definitely, across multiple botulinum toxin brands, has definitely been shown to be effective in reducing Sialorrhea.
What treatments, if any, would be considered failures prior to using botulinum toxin injections for this entity?
Potentially either the scopolamine patch or glycopyrrolate. However, individuals with Parkinson's disease and hallucinations should not take those medications because they both can cause or worsen hallucinations. So there's certain contraindications to using them that I would go straight, would lead me to go straight to botulinum toxin injections and defer those medication treatments.
Is there a dose-response relationship for Sialorrhea with botulinum toxin?
Certainly, if a patient does not notice as great a response, I have gone up on the dose and they do have a better response with higher doses. I typically start with the FDA-approved dosing recommendations.
Okay. Is there any evidence to support any limitations for frequency intervals or treatment durations for this condition?
In my clinical opinion and experience, the patients continue to receive benefit years after initiating injections. However, some individuals do notice that injections may wear off before 12 weeks. And I've been able to see, like, if the injections wear off at 10 weeks, just by default injecting patients every 10 weeks if insurance approves allows good coverage or treatment without having to necessarily change the type of botulinum toxin brand.
What contraindications might there be for the use of botulinum toxin?
If the patient already has excessive dry mouth, or in some cases, potentially dysphagia.
And are there any long-term effects for use of botulinum toxin?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. That concludes this section for me, unless anyone else has any questions.
Dr. Kelly, I did have some questions, just a little bit of clarification. Stephanie, could you go back one slide, please? So when it comes to the dose, like what we would consider an off-label dose, is there any literature to support using off-label doses?
I am not specifically sure on that. I'm not going to make a statement that that is the case, but
okay.
In my own clinical practice or experience, going above initial dosing definitely has benefited the patient.
Okay. Yeah, I do realize that clinically, but I just wanted to see whether there was, like how would you decide what off-label dose to use? So that's why I was kind of asking if there was any literature that shows how to kind of step that up or something.
I most commonly inject ZMN and then will increase in increments of 50 units. But that's just my own personal experience.
Okay. All right, thank you. That's all I wanted to ask, just to kind of clarify that portion. Does anybody else have any questions for Dr. Kelly concerning this topic? No. Okay. We'll go on to the next topic, Stephanie. Thank you. Dr. Trima, that will be you with Dr. Parada, Dr. Kelly Faison, and Dr. Christina Kwasnicka. So, Dr. Trima, are you on?
I am on. I'm ready to
go. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. If anybody hears in the background screeching, that's the Blue Angels going by, and no matter what I do, I can't lessen the noise. Anyhow, so I apologize if you hear that in the background. Is there any evidence regarding the use of botulinum toxin for spasticity?
Hi, this is John Barada. I'm glad to go first, maybe we could take turns since there are three of us. Yes, there is good evidence among a number of large trials showing that botulinum toxin is effective for reduction of spasticity in both upper and lower limbs.
And this is Tina Kwasnicka. I would agree. There's significant evidence in the use of spasticity of cerebral origin, both for upper and lower extremities, with each one of the botulinum toxin preparations.
And I would concur with them. There's not much to really add to that.
All right. I'll quickly follow up on your question. You said of all the different botulinum toxins. From what I understand, not all of them are approved for those indications. Wouldn't that be correct?
That is correct. So, onabotulinum toxin is approved for upper and lower limb spasticity. ABO is approved for upper and lower. INCO is approved for only upper, and I think RIBO is only approved for upper as well. And that's the botulinum toxin B.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. What treatments, if any, would be considered failures prior to using botulinum toxin injections?
So this is Tina Kwasnicka. I guess I feel pretty passionate about this. I think that the literature does not support the need to show a failure of oral medications prior to instituting botulinum toxin injections. There is specific literature in comparison with tizanidine and the neurotoxins, and then there is really, if you pull apart the data on things such as baclofen and at a lower level diazepam and tizanidine, the literature doesn't support that there has to have been a trial of those prior to undergoing neurotoxin treatment.
Okay, thank you. All right, the third question, I'm going to phrase it a little bit differently, and basically when and when is not EMG or nerve stimulation used or necessary for the treatment of spasticity?
I routinely use EMG guidance when targeting muscles. I think it's important, especially if it's specific to certain muscles and it's not just like complete contracture that you're targeting. I think it provides assistance and good clinical evidence that you've hit the correct muscle target.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I believe that, the product inserts, all our training tells us that you should use something to localize, though doesn't differentiate between EMG, nerve stimulation, and currently ultrasound guidance, but does believe that there needs to be something beyond anatomic localization. It's interesting when you peruse the literature, because that's the standard of treatment, to find literature studies in the last 10 to 15 years that even compare anatomic guidance to guided injection is incredibly difficult to find. So it is it's a standard, and really at this point in time is really the question of, is there a difference between the electrical variations, EMG and nerve stimulation, versus the ultrasound, which is kind of the next question to be asked for those of us who are injecting for spasticity.
All right, thank you. What about what objective criteria or scale should be used to measure outcomes, if any?
Uh, I think monitoring patient spasticity with a scale such as modified Ashworth is appropriate, and I think many providers use that. Some others could assess range of motion, caregiver burden, pain, et cetera, but I think modified Ashworth is the most reasonable in a clinical setting.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think in clinical practice, modified Ashworth is kind of the baseline of what we're monitoring, but then beyond that, because the functional scales that were used in the different studies allow for a variation in what the functional outcome is for the patient, whether it be a patient movement outcome versus caregiver outcome versus pain outcome, usually we just use a goal setting and goal attainment scale. So the patient sets the goal prior, the physician discusses the goals, and then you assess at the follow-up whether that goal was attained or how you may need to change the goal or change the approach to attain the goal.
All right. Thank you. All right, next slide, please. Okay. So your typical questions in the first question, is there any anything in literature that supports different dosing regimens than recommended by the or approved by the FDA?
I think there's pretty significant literature out there that talks about dosing up to 600 units. You know, I think that there are at least 600 units of onobotulinum toxin. I think that the different studies have, you know, had to, they're often done in the open label extension phase, and because of the FDA package insert, also, though there is not interchangeability between the different toxins, from a potency point of view, the level at which you can dose abobotulinum toxin is actually got more potency than the onobotulinum toxin, which kind of goes along with the clinical practice as it is. So I think there's enough literature to support that dose going up to 600 units. And I think for those of us who are practicing, especially if you're doing two-limb spasticity, that's a pretty typical dose for treatment.
Okay. I'm going to piggyback on that question, on that answer that you had there. Using those larger volume of units of Botox, how concerned are you if you say you're treating two limbs at a time or bilateral limbs at a time? You're using a large volume of units. When do you start worrying about things such as systemic toxicity at that point?
So in my clinical practice, I usually weigh the risk with regards to the patient and the amount of muscles that are being treated that are close to the neck, like shoulder girdle muscles, as far as whether I have a concern specifically about weakness leading to dysphagia is the side effect that most concerns me in my population. So I think that being very careful with regards to timing of dosing, making sure somebody doesn't have an intercurrent illness, you know, making sure, I actually think when I'm going at 600 units, using the 90 days is the safest route for those patients because you allow a bigger gap between injection that potentially is going to decrease that potential for risk. And then, you know, obviously, localization, knowing where you're at and where you're putting that medication. Being cautious as far as volume injected as well, because increasing the volume injected can be pretty powerful in concert with the higher dose.
Okay, so that you mentioned, though, in your clinical practice, supporting literature, though, for using large volumes of Botox, you know, and risks of serious adverse effects.
Right. So, you know, there are, And I work in both the pediatric and the adult space. So there are definitely cases of systemic botulism and systemic side effects from the higher doses, generally more actually discussed in the pediatric realm because the dose per body weight is far higher than the dose per body weight in an adult. So that's where those original cases came from. In the majority of my patients, if we're staying at that like 600, the literature in both in the practice guideline from the AAN, some of the other like the these extension studies that were done, they really show, like the Aspire trial and that, they didn't show any difficulty up to that 600 units. The question is beyond that, and beyond that is not in large trials. Beyond that is in case series or case reports. Do you get any extra benefit to treating above 600 units, or is your risk then, you know, is the risk exceed your potential benefit?
All right, one last question, and most of these have already been asked. It's going to deviate a little bit. So you mentioned a time interval. So if you're injecting large volumes of or large amounts, units of Botox for treatment of spasticity, especially in the limbs, whether it be the upper or the lower limbs, you mentioned 90-day intervals between treatments. So is there any guidelines, either societal guidelines or literature, that supports more frequent or less frequent intervals?
There are no societal guidelines supporting less frequent intervals. So the practice guidelines that came out of the AAN do not support less frequent intervals. There is upcoming guidelines from the APMNR that will, I don't believe, support less frequent intervals. I think that we haven't, I'll speak as somebody who's injected for many years and many patients who've been receiving injections for 15, 20 years, we're not seeing immunogenicity in the way that we thought we had originally thought we were going to see. However, I think we still are cautious that in what we're doing with spasticity, we really are injecting at a higher dose than some of the other indications, and so moving the bar closer, unless it's a special situation where your risk outweighs the benefit outweighs the risk, that there's not a lot of benefit to making that interval shorter.
All right, that's really the last question I have. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much. Dr. Trimas, if you could stay on. Dr. Yang was able to join us, and since we appear to have a little bit of time, we want to give her opportunity to kind of answer the questions on facial dystonia, and then after that, I would need Dr. Kettler to also go ahead and ask her the questions. So, Dr. Yang, if you're on, if you could start by, if you can come off mute and start by introducing yourself, tell us your affiliation, and any conflicts of interest, if there are any. Thank you very much for coming.
Yes, thanks for having me. So my name is Cheyenne Yang. I am an assistant professor of otolaryngology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and I don't have any associated conflicts of interest or no disclosures.
All righty. Would you like me to repeat the questions then again, or does Dr. Yang have access to those slides as well?
I do have access to those slides. So.
All right. If you want comments, and you don't necessarily have to because they've already, the other expert have also made comments, but if you'd like to make any comments to questions, free, go right ahead.
Sure. I guess just in terms of hemifacial spasms, I think there's a decent amount of literature and evidence to suggest that it has significant benefit on patients. The majority of patients I treat have hemifacial spasms, kind of secondary hemifacial spasms, so secondary to some type of injury to the facial nerve. And in terms of prior treatments before, I would say with the kind of secondary hemifacial spasm, one of the main things that I recommend treatment is physical therapy, typically before Botox therapy, but usually in conjunction with botulinum toxin injections. And I think the only kind of other thing I would ask or add is in terms of objective criteria and scales to measure the benefits and outcomes. I know there's a lot of different scales in terms of measuring how we're grading these patients. I don't think there's been any standardized. I think if you look between different specialties, there's different ways to grade things. So if you're looking at primary hemifacial spasm, most people may look at the hemifacial spasm grading scale. But when we're looking at kind of secondary hemifacial spasm, or we also call synkinesis, we have different grading scales to evaluate these patients, both patient-graded measures as well as physician-graded measures. So I think it's important to have some type of patient-related measures to get – it really guides kind of what your outcomes and treatment and how you're going to continue treating these patients, because I don't think there are standard – doses. I think it's kind of a tailored plan to each patient.
All righty. Do you want to go ahead and pull up the next set of slides?
Oh, Stephanie,
in terms of the condition for the literature, robust literature. I mean, there's been a lot of different studies showing the efficacy of botulinum toxin used in these patients, and the dosing is difficult because there's no label in terms of how much you should dose these patients. So I think it's, again, just starting at a lower, safer doses. There have been different literature published to show kind of starting off doses in certain muscles, because essentially you're treating the entire face, and ensuring that you're starting at these lower doses will help kind of you escalate and scale treatment from there. Is there a dose-response relation? Yes. I mean, if you're injecting these patients with higher doses of Botox, you're going to see it's not necessarily they're going to have a better response. They just may have a different type of response in terms of the symptoms they're having. And if you over-inject these patients, you may result in weakness. That may be weakness in now closing the eye, or more trouble with speaking or eating. And then evidence. In terms of evidence to support limitations for frequency and intervals, I think general duration, I treat most of my patients is every 3 months. And I've been treating patients, there have been patients who are getting treatment for 10, 15, 20 years. So I don't think there is a finality to it that there's, you know, you guys have asked previously, is there a safety concern on how long to treat these patients? I think the overwhelming consensus is that it's relatively well tolerated.
Dr. Yang, I just wanted to interject that for those two, it's like, is there evidence pointing to it? So
I don't know of any, in terms of the intervals to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is evidence in terms that there's, I believe it ranges between like 70% and 98% effectiveness every 12 weeks.
Okay, and some studies cite
between 3 to 4 months. I don't know of any specific studies that say a specific period of time, because essentially you're never going to cure patients with just botulinum toxin. They're going to need this therapy indefinitely.
Okay.
I'll just jump in and say, this is Prem Subramanian. I mentioned earlier that there are retrospective studies for 10 to 15 years of treatment of patients showing continued effect, continued efficacy, tolerability, and, in fact, a lower rate of adverse events as time goes on.
Thank you. So, Dr. Yang, we're going to go on to the blepharospasm. And Dr. Kessler, if you're still on, would you like to take this?
Sure. I guess the first two questions are somewhat related in that, I guess number two, first of all, are there treatments that should be tried prior to providing Botox for blepharospasm?
In my practice, Botox, and no, I mean, Botox is first-line therapy for it.
Okay. And would you say that's a pretty general practice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. If I may, Dr. Kindler, one point I forgot to make earlier on when we discussed this is that I think it's important for the panel and others to keep in mind that botulinum toxin was actually developed in the lab by Alan Scott over 40 years ago, specifically because what we had to treat blepharospasm was incredibly poor. And so all the initial studies leading to the FDA approval of this drug really were centered around the treatment of blepharospasm, hemifacial spasm, and paralytic strabismus, primarily because there were no other good treatments.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point because essentially that is how Botox was developed, and now for blepharospasms. And I think it also is a testament to how safe it has, how well tolerated it's been in these patients.
Okay. All right. And are there objective criteria that can be used to determine treatment effect and also when patients would need a repeat injection?
So a lot of my practice is driven, again, I use some of the scales like the facial clinometric scale, the SAQ scale, which may be a little bit different than what an ophthalmologist may use, but a lot of my practice is driven by patient-driven reported improvements. So if they're saying, you know, my eye doesn't feel as tight, there's less blinking, I'm not having as much pain, vision is better, a lot of it is going to be subjective compared to objective.
Okay, thank you.
But objective, rightfully so, would be on physical exam and examining the patient and seeing, you know, how much are they actually spasming, how does the eye look in comparison to the other eye.
Okay. Let's see. Is there a reason to provide injections more often than every 3 months? I think you mentioned for the issue we just discussed that you typically do 3 months. How about with blepharospasm?
Typically what I find is that it's more I need to increase the dose. If a patient comes to me saying, you know, before that 12-week period saying, oh, my dose wore off too quickly, it's more so that I need to increase the dose. So I tend to stick with the 12-week therapy. I do not know of studies looking at shorter ranges of therapy for that, but in my own practice, it's more that the dose needs to be increased rather than decreasing the time interval.
Okay. Is there evidence to support either staying with one preparation for the duration, or is there a need to switch amongst the different preparations?
So people do talk about concern for potential antibody formation and trying different types of botulinum toxin. Personally, I've had to do it maybe in one or two patients. It's pretty rare in my practice. So I think it is pretty safe to stay with a single neuromodulator therapy. And if you're seeing after a while either the patients who require an increased amount of dose or they're feeling like it's wearing off sooner, then that could be a consideration for trying a different type of therapy.
Okay. Do you feel there are any contraindications to the use of botulinum toxin injections?
The only contraindications would be if they have some other type of neuromuscular disorder. If for some reason at the office site there was some type of infection or local, you know, skin reaction around the skin, that would be temporary in which you wouldn't want to inject in that area.
Okay. Ola, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of all of us, that is National Government Services, Noridian, Novitas Solutions, First Coast, Wisconsin Physician Services, Palmetto GBA, and CGS, I would like to thank everyone, especially the subject matter experts, for making this meeting a very robust one, and I'm sure we all enjoyed the discussion. So thank you very, very much. In terms of next steps, I wanted to first of all remind everybody that we usually use evidence about being our guide, which I had quoted in the beginning. According to our work instructions, evidence and literature is the main stake of our guides, along with guidelines. The next thing for us will be to go back, re-listen to this, and start our process to develop a draft policy on this. In a while, after this has been transcribed, the recording transcribed, there will be access to both the recording and the transcription on our various web pages. So just stay tuned and just continue to check, and you will be able to see it when it's available. So in lieu of any other comments by any of my co-CMBs, which does anybody want to have any closing comments that they would like to make? Okay. Hearing none, we'd like to thank everybody, and the meeting is officially over. Thank you very much. You may now hang up.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time. Mm-hmm.